Good morning. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. My name's Jane, and I'm really delighted to be here with Pip Williams to talk about her beautiful book, The Bookbinder of Jericho. We're just going to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting here today on Kaurna Yirrta, the land of the big red kangaroo. This place has been a gathering place for storytelling and sharing for millennia, and it's a real privilege and honour to continue that today. And I just want to pay my respects to elders past and present. So Pip Williams, I'm sure, needs no introduction for this audience, but we'll do one anyway. Pip Williams is the author of One Italian Summer, a critically acclaimed memoir of her family's travels in search of the good life. Her first novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words, based on her original research in the Oxford English Dictionary Archives, was published in 2020 and became an international bestseller. The Bookbinder of Jericho is her second novel and a companion novel to The Dictionary of Lost Words. Please join me in welcoming Pip.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you.
So I think one of the really lovely things about Writers' Week is getting to hear the writers' words from their own mouth. And so Pip's going to open us up with a bit of a reading.
So I thought I'd read from near the beginning of the novel, and it's just a passage that introduces a few of the characters and some of the themes, I suppose, of the book. It was a relief to look upon Calliope. She was dark blue with gold lettering, like the binding of an Oxford World's classic. She was practically touching staying put, and the closeness had always felt like a comfort. I held open the hatch for Maud and stepped in after her. Calliope smelled a little sweet after having been shut up all day, a little earthy. The hatch swung closed behind me and I breathed it in. It's the smell of books, Ma used to tell people when they asked. It's the paper decomposing. They'd screw up their noses and Ma would laugh and say, I've come to love it. Ma had brought two books with her when she first moved on to Calliope, translations of the Odyssey and the Tragedies of Euripides, Volume 2. They'd belonged to her own mother and were worn from reading. Her collecting had only started after we were born. She picked up books at curiosity shops and fetes, and sometimes she bought them new, Everyman's Library editions for a shilling each. Most, though, were from the press. They were bound, but they had defects. Whenever I asked if she'd been given permission to bring one home, she'd never quite answer. It's a waste, she'd say. Not good enough to sell. Then she'd hand it to me. But good enough to read, don't you think? I always said yes, though when I was small, I could barely understand a word of them. Ma stored her books on a row of narrow shelving that ran between the windows bow to stern. When those shelves were full, Oberon Rowntree built her another row. Soon after that, he built another. When we were 10 years old, he told her a fourth row of shelves could not be accommodated. So Ma bought a small bookcase from the bric-a-brac woman at the covered market. It had been dragged from the river at low tide and looked worthless. But Ma cleaned it, then sanded it, then oiled it. She placed it beside her armchair just inside the hatch. Then she filled it with her favourite novels and all her Greek myths. Why do we have so many books? I like to ask. To expand your world, she would say. When she died, my world shrank. That was when my own collecting began. Unbound manuscripts, parts of books, single sections, pages with no clue as to the title or author. In 3 years, our shelves had lost their order. Calliope became messy with fragmented ideas and parts of stories. There were beginnings with no endings and endings with no beginnings, and I stored them wherever they would fit, and in plenty of places they didn't. They were tucked between bound volumes and piled under the table. A few sewn manuscripts with no boards rested in the plate rack above the galley bench. Finally, there were pages I didn't care for. We cut them square and stored them in an old biscuit tin that we kept on the table. While I cooked, Maud folded them into all manner of shapes. Folding for her was like breathing, and she'd been doing it since she was little. For as long as I could remember, her creations had been strung around Calliope like bunting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is the companion novel to The Dictionary of Lost Words, and you've found the idea for this book while researching your first book, well, The Dictionary. Could you talk a bit about that research process, and when did this book and the idea for this book arise through your research?
Yeah, absolutely. So The Dictionary of Lost Words was a book that that required a lot of research. For anyone who's read it, you'll probably guess that. And so I had to spend quite a lot of time in Oxford, and in particularly in the archives of Oxford University Press. And before I published The Dictionary of Lost Words, I had written the manuscript, but there were little gaps that I needed to do some research for. I went back to Oxford and spent some time at the press filling in those gaps. And one of the gaps that I wanted to fill in was there was a section in that first novel about a book being bound, and I won't talk too much about it in case it's a spoiler, but a book is being bound, and it's being bound in secret, and everyone in the press is helping with this binding. And I wanted to know a little bit about the women who worked in the bindery, the women who would have been helping to bind this book. And so I asked the archivist if he had any information at all about the women who used to work in the bindery around during the war. And he brought me three things. He brought me a photograph of women actually from the early 1920s working in the bindery, where they would fold all of the pages that came off the printing presses into sections, and that was a still photograph. And it showed row upon row upon row of women in aprons with papers piled high on one side and sections on another. And it was a really wonderful photograph and gave me actually quite a lot of detail that I needed to write about women in the bindery. But it was still a single photograph. Mm. The other thing he showed me was a film about a book being made at Oxford University Press, again in the early 1920s, so almost contemporary to when I was writing. And that film, on the whole, was about the men who worked at the press, but there were two sections where women were shown, and one was the folding, and the other was a woman gathering those sections that had been folded into her arm. And so she's walking, dancing almost, along a gathering bench, which is piled with many, many piles of sections, just gathering them into her arm very fast, very beautifully, actually, very accurately. And as I was watching the film, I just thought to myself, I wonder what the book is that she's gathering into her arm. I remember stopping the film to try and peer at it, and I couldn't figure out what the book was. But the next thought that came into my mind was, I wonder if she ever stops to read what she's gathering. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I had that thought, my mind just tumbled along other thoughts and landed essentially on a fictional character called Peggy, who looked a lot like this woman in the film, who I suspect, if you watch this film, and you can actually get it online, I suspect she knew she was going to be filmed that day because she's not wearing her apron and she's wearing a nice pair of high heels and she looks very elegant. But I suddenly had this idea of a woman who would stop to read the pages. And so the next image, I suppose, in my mind, I've got this woman stopping mid-dance to read a page in her arms. And the next thing that would have happened was her supervisor would have come over and reprimanded her. Yeah. And I imagined what that supervisor might have said, and it was, your job is to bind the books, not read them. And I wrote that line down in my notebook because I hadn't finished writing The Dictionary of Lost Words and I didn't have time to start writing another book. But that's where the idea for Peggy and this book started, and I just had to put it aside. But it's that line that stayed in my head.
Mm. Yeah. And when you're sort of talking, when you're in the process of writing these books, where does the research stop and the writing begin, or are they always intertwined?
I actually do quite a lot of reading before I start writing. Actually, that's not true. Normally I get an idea and I write a scene. That's the very first thing that happens. And from that idea, I actually very quickly have I suppose, a story arc, what we might call a story arc. So not all the details, not all the plot points, but I tend to know where the story might go. And but then as soon as I've written that first scene, I start doing my reading. And the reading is quite wide. I want to know about the context. I want to know, in both of these books, I was interested actually in something quite specific. The first, I was interested in the Oxford English Dictionary. There is plenty to read about the Oxford English Dictionary. And doing that reading is quite informative in terms of what has not been considered mm-hmm. in the history of that project. For this book, I was interested in Oxford University Press. So the history of the press, the history of bookbinding, who did the bookbinding, what is bookbinding? I had never bound a book. I, like every single person here, I adore books. And probably like most people here, I bet if I did a survey, if I asked people to put their hand up, if they prefer e-books over paper books, I bet there's not a... Okay, there's three hands have gone up. Good for you. But the majority of us still... We still love the paper book. We still love to hold the book in our hands. We love to... Excellent. Yes, we get a clap. We love to crack it open, or we love to see the marginalia that's in the book from people who've read it before us. It's an artifact. The solid book is an artifact, and I, as much as I love them, I had never once thought how that book was made, mm-hmm. and so for this book, my interest really was in the making of a book, and who makes the book, and what are the lives like of the people who make the book. Oxford University Press was a fascinating place to do the research because the story and the research do happen at the same time. I do a bit of research and it gives me an idea for my character or for the place or for how the story might progress. And so for me, once I've done that reading initially, the research and writing happen simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you touched on it there, but when you were looking at a lot of those histories and women weren't written into those histories and women didn't write those histories, what do you think is the role of fiction in telling historical stories?
I love this question. What has happened with the books that I've written and actually historical fiction that you will have heard about at this festival and other festivals and read yourself... We are often, especially if we're writing about women, we are often writing about a history that hasn't been written down mm-hmm. and also a history that hasn't been archived. So we often talk about the fact that certain people have been left out of history or their perspective has been left out of history, and women is the focus here, but we can also include First Nations people, immigrants, refugees, there are so many groups of people, young people, there are so many groups of people who have been left out of history because they weren't the history writers. They also weren't the archivists. And mm-hmm. so one of the problems when you're writing about a group that's been left out of the history books, the first thing you do is go to the archives and you think, okay, I'll just dig out all of the things that haven't been used by the writers of history. Now, when I went to the archives, I didn't finish telling you about the three things that Martin Moore, who has been... He's the archivist at Oxford University Press and has been incredibly helpful to me. When I asked him to bring me things about the men's work at the press, he could bring me boxes and boxes and boxes of materials, including a wonderful newsletter that came out in 1919 after World War I to help kind of reintegrate all of the workers who'd come back from the war. And it's full of stories and anecdotes about people who work at the press, not about the war at all, but actually about the people's jobs at the press and different individuals and so on. And there's not a single story in that newsletter, which ran for many years, not a single story about one of the women, one of the 100 or so women who worked at the press. Mm-hmm. Plenty of stories about the men, boxes and boxes of archival material about what the men did. Wow. But as I said, in terms of the women, there was one photograph, there was a few seconds in a 20-minute film. And the other thing that I found, and which I have reproduced in the book, is a page from a farewell card, essentially, a farewell card for Horace Hart, who was the controller of the press, the head printer. And in that card, everyone who worked at the press had signed it. And there was a section for the bindery, and that page includes the men from the bindery, the men's side of the bindery, and also the nearly 50 women who worked on the girls' side of the bindery. And so there I have the signatures and the names of every woman who worked in the bindery during the time that I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. And that was very precious, yeah. Very precious. But that's it. Those three tiny bits of archival material made up everything that they had kept mm-hmm. of the women who worked in the bindery. And so when we're writing about women in history, it's not just that what's been published has gaps, it's what's been kept has gaps. So when I was writing this book, I had to think, how do I write about these women whose lives haven't been valuable enough to have kept in any way, not just written down, but the bits and pieces haven't been kept. One thing I thought about doing was looking at art, women's art at the time. And I did that. I read Vera Brittain's memoir, A Testament of Youth, which I'm sure some of you know about. In fact, I have to acknowledge her memoir has been extremely useful in all of in both of these novels, and I acknowledge that. Because she wrote this very detailed, beautiful memoir of her life just before World War I, her life in Oxford at Somerville College, and then her life as a VAD at ETAP in France. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who's read the book would recognise some of those places as appearing in the book. So I read her memoir, I read poetry that had been written at the time, I looked at visual art that had been written and novels, and that was all very useful. It gives me a sense of women's lives at that time. But when I analysed who the women were who were producing this art, mm-hmm. I realised that they were all women with a room of their own and 700 a year, yeah. As Virginia Woolf would say. These were middle and upper class women who had the time and the money to produce art. And what I couldn't find was art from working class women. And the reason I can't find it, I think, is because they have no time. I mean, they were working long hours and then coming home and cooking and cleaning and caring for children. They didn't have time to leave anything behind. I think, you know, one of my characters in Dictionary of Lost Words says everything she does is eaten or burnt, and by the end of the day there is nothing left mm-hmm. to say she's been here. And unfortunately for many working class women throughout history, that has been the case.
Mm-hmm. And you touched on it there, the sort of the book talks about, it's in some ways it's a very small story. It's about a woman and her working life and a working class woman, but it's also under the lens of the First World War, the Spanish flu. So how do you sort of, what's the process when you're writing of telling like a personal story but also acknowledging this wider, broader story of the world?
Yeah. First of all, I have to privilege the personal story. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the character. In many ways, I don't ignore what's happening in the greater world, but I engage with it in the way my character might engage with it. And so in this book, even though it in many ways it's bound by the years of the war, it starts in 1914 and it ostensibly ends at the end of the war, though it goes a little further. So the war is ever present, but because I'm writing it from the perspective of a woman who stays home and just continues working like most women did, and she's also a young woman who doesn't have any skin in the game, so to speak. So she's not a woman who's waiting for someone to come home. Her father, brother, lover has not gone to the war. And so it's not a story that, and there are many of them, it's not a story of a woman who's waiting for a loved one to return, which again, in some ways, privileges, in some ways, it includes the man's experience of that war. This is adjacent, in a way, to the usual stories of World War One, and I also was interested in not just women who stayed home and worked, but also women who fled war. And so there are other characters in here who are refugees, and one of them is a woman, and one of them actually isn't a refugee, but he's an injured Belgian soldier. And I was interested in these other characters. And I'm chatting on and on now because I'm trying to remember what Jane's original question was. And I'm hoping as I talk, it's just going to come to me, but it's not.
It was about the sort of how do you balance telling the personal story history?
It was such a good question too. So I privileged the personal story. Mm-hmm. And when my characters engage in the greater world, it's my job to find out what was happening in that wider world. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the war was ever-present, but there were other things happening as well. You know, there was the women's suffrage movement had been put on hold, and so I had to understand, actually, what had happened to the women's suffrage movement at this time. My first novel, the women's suffrage movement, is in full bloom. And so... A lot of that novel talks about or includes that period in history. When World War One started, there was a pulling back from many of the suffrage groups, and so I have to reflect that as well in the story, which I tried to do. And so I engage with the historical research in that sense in the same way that my characters do. One of the things about this book is that it's in five sections, and each section is headed by a book that Peggy is actually binding at the press. And all of these books are books that were bound at Oxford University Press at that time. And except for one, I managed to get my hands on actual editions mm-hmm. that were bound and held and worked on by the women who put their signatures on the... that farewell card I was telling you about. So I was lucky enough to handle them. The one I didn't get to handle was The Anatomy of Melancholy, unfortunately. And that was important to me because I wanted to know what they feel like, what they look like. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to dip into them in the same way Peggy might have as she was folding. So these are not books that I necessarily had any... previous experience of. They're not books I had read and devoured and analysed. These are books that I came across in my work, doing the research for this novel, in the same way Peggy might have come across them in her work. And I try to engage with them in the same way she might have engaged with them so that I could get a little bit of a sense of what her reaction might have been to some of the things that she read and then include that reaction in her story.
You were just talking then about these books that were bound and being able to handle them, but you also learnt some bookbinding while you were writing this book. Do you want to tell us a bit about that process?
I did. I don't know if Peter Zajac is here today, but Peter is he works at the State Library of South Australia, just a few doors down. And the State Library of South Australia, I mean, you know, libraries have been so important to me, libraries and archives. Because I don't live in Oxford full time, I do live in South Australia. I've spent a lot of time at my local State Library for both of these novels. And it has been, I wouldn't have been able to write these books actually without the State Library. Mm-hmm. And for this book in particular, I was very lucky because Peter Zajac he was apprenticed as a bookbinder when he was 15 or 16, back in the early 70s. Yeah. And he is the last remaining bookbinder at the State Library. I think when he started, he said there were 53 people in the bookbinding section, and it was divided exactly like the Oxford University Press bindery, there was a men's side and a girl's side. I hope everyone's noticing the language there. And so he was invaluable for so many reasons. First of all, he worked under a similar regime as Oxford University Press, so he could talk about that. Secondly, he learnt bookbinding in the traditional way, the same way that my characters would have bound books, is the way he was taught to bind books. He could read sections that I wrote about the binding process and just make sure that I was describing it in an authentic way, so that was invaluable. But most of all, he helped me to bind my own book. And so he would, during the writing of the book, he would teach me how to do certain processes, so I had a tangible understanding of what it might feel like to bind a book. But when the pages of my own book had been printed, we got 7 copies of it, and I spent, you know, many sessions at the State Library with Peter helping me to bind 7 copies of my own book.
Wow.
Yeah, going through all of those processes. Thank you. Oh, don't clap me. Thank you, Peter. Hope you can hear me. And if you want, you can actually, we did video it, so even though it took maybe, I can't tell you how slow, I would have been fired, no doubt about it. And actually, Peter, he went away and had lunch and left me sewing one of my books together, so sewing, doing the sewing. And when, and then he came back and I went home and I came back another day and the book was there and he said, you have to undo it. I went, what? So he was a hard taskmaster, but that book might have fallen apart and now it won't. And you can see a video of me binding the book online, and the videographer and Peter make me look good. There's a lot of jiggery-pokery going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. And were you like the bookbinder at Oxford? You like put your heels on and your nice outfit?
No, I had my jeans. And,
Both of these books are really about a love of words and a love of language and a love of the way that love can open up the world and possibilities in the world. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about where your love of languages comes from, or love of language and love of words comes from.
Yeah. I think it's probably safe to say I have a love-hate relationship with language and words. Not language, but with words. So some of you might know I'm dyslexic, so words were problematic for me throughout my life, probably, and anyone who has to live with me, they still are in, you know, shopping lists and, you know, all sorts of things can sometimes be a bit incomprehensible. But as someone who is dyslexic, words posed a problem, not so much in the creative composition of sentences, poems, birthday cards, you know, early attempts at short stories. That wasn't actually the issue, because dyslexia isn't about kind of how you create a language-based sort of product. It's about the how you represent the tools of language. And so because my spelling was poor and my writing was poor, that is what people would focus on sometimes when I was little. But I was very lucky in that my parents tended not to. My parents were parents of the 70s. I don't know how many people here grew up as children of the 70s, when I think the parent paradigm was really just to praise absolutely everything that you did. So any stick figure was a work of art. Any really badly spelt and written poem was a work of literature. Mm-hmm. And my parents were very encouraging of what I was attempting to do. And I think that's the difference between someone who's dyslexic or has any kind of learning difference, who I suppose progresses to use language in a creative way and those who don't. So I've come across many people at festivals in signing cues and so on who similarly had dyslexia as children, but the focus on their dyslexia was all about everything they were doing wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, every piece of writing they handed up would be criticised for the way the words were spelt or the way they looked, rather than the ideas they were trying to express or the creativity that was in their piece. And it stopped them from writing because it became an aversive experience. I didn't have that so much, and I'm very grateful that I didn't. Mm-hmm. But my relationship was still a slightly love-hate, and with dictionaries in particular, because I was always being given dictionaries for birthdays to try and overcome my spelling problem, which is really the weirdest thing to do, because if you can't spell, you can't look a word up in a dictionary.
I had exactly the same experience, like trying to figure out can I get the first three letters? Like, maybe then I can find it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really interesting what you were saying about, like, praise and the access that you were given to creativity and the celebration of that. And I think that's really interesting in relation to the book Binder of Jericho, because Peggy, we've touched on, is a working class woman. She leaves school at 12 in the novel, I believe, and works in the bookbindery with other working class women, but it's in really close proximity to Oxford University, and there's a real divide between the town and the gown. And she dreams of going to Somerville, the women's college, but it doesn't seem like it's an accessible dream for her. Can you write about that sort of arc for that character?
Yeah, so all of those details are true to history. So, you know, most Jericho, where Oxford University Press is a neighbourhood of Oxford, and at the time it was a very working class, very poor neighbourhood of Oxford. Now it's not. Now it's, you know, if you've been to Oxford and you've wandered around Jericho, it's a much zhuzhier place. But back then it was a poor place, and about 60 or more percent of the people who lived there were somehow related to Oxford University Press. They worked there or they supported the press, the business of the press. But also Oxford University Press belonged to the university. So everyone who worked there was a servant of the university. And it's a beautiful building. It looks like a university building, and it's nestled amongst all these workers' cottages. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting place. But it would have been quite typical for the girls of Jericho who went to St Barnabas Primary School to leave at 12, and the boys as well, and to become apprenticed at the press to sort of follow in the footsteps of their parents and grandparents, because it was also that kind of a place. It was a company town, essentially. Mm-hmm. And generations of the same family worked at the press. Many, many girls and boys who showed academic potential would go on to high school of some kind, or to education of some kind. And Peggy is offered this, actually, but she decides she wants to stay with her identical twin sister, Maud, and so she leaves school to stay with her sister and to support her mother, who is a single mother, essentially, to support her mother with an income. And so these details are fairly typical of the history, but her desire for an education and her inability to access it is also typical, unfortunately, at that time. And you were saying earlier, asking about historical fiction and how it, you know, the importance of it. One of the other things I think is important about historical fiction, or what I like to read in historical fiction, I like to think about my present and how the history might inform what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing the research for this book, I can't help thinking about access to education then and now. And even though we feel like we have much better access to education, actually there are so many groups of people whose access to education mirrors Peggy's. It is still something that's very, very difficult for many groups of people. And so it was a very interesting thing to research and write about. Mm-hmm. Back then, being a woman was one barrier to tertiary education. being working class made it almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Having left school at 12, again, makes it almost impossible. And so Peggy's desire, Peggy's, you know, dream of going to Somerville Ladies' College was impossible even to her until the war started. Mm-hmm. And World War One sort of shook everything up a little bit and made all sorts of things more possible for women in particular.
Mm-hmm. And you just touched on it there, what the reason that Peggy decides to leave school is to stay with her identical twin sister, Maud, who today we might say she has autism, but they didn't have that language back then. I'm interested in how you sort of created that character and how you from this perspective, from 2024, look back at someone who might have had autism during that time.
Hmm. I have experience of autism in my family. And also I did my research and I spoke to people who have expertise in autism, but not autism. Autism is as varied as any, but people with autism, and there would be many people here who are autistic or who have someone in their family who's autistic. It's just one of the many ways of living and being and experiencing the world. I feel like I want to see the people in books that I see around me all the time. And so Maud really, she just naturally occurred. She naturally appeared as Peggy's sister very early on, actually. I knew Peggy would be a twin. And I spoke to people. I was very interested. I'm always interested in language and how we communicate. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted Maud to communicate in a way that was different to the way other people communicate. And she communicates in a way that echoes language. And we call it these days echolalia. And unfortunately, there's very little research about echolalia. It is a particular language, a way that people learn and use language. It particularly happens in children these days. Mm-hmm. And through therapy, their language changes over time. But I was imagining what might have happened to a child who uses echolalia who got no therapy. Mm-hmm. And instead, the people around her learn her language, essentially. The people around her learn to translate and understand and communicate with her on her terms. So I was interested in that. Very little research in echolalia in adults, mm-hmm. But I spoke to some people who are doing that research just to ensure that I was sort of getting it right. And what was important to me, though, is not to have a character who's just a foil for my main character, Peggy, but a character who's actually fully fleshed and rounded and has a story of her own. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that having Maud in there, she wasn't in there really as a trope or a stereotype of any kind. And I hope that people who are autistic or live with someone who's autistic, I hope that she works for them. And mm-hmm. I have had some lovely feedback from young women in particular.
Yeah.
About Maud. She was one of my favourite characters, very hard to write because she doesn't use language in the same way mm-hmm. as everybody else. But I wanted her also in there as a truth teller. So the way she uses language, it's very economical. She repeats what she hears, but she never tells a falsehood. And so, she was very important to the story.
Mm-hmm. And the other question that I had around sort of parallels between now and the book was the Spanish flu happens during the book, and you were writing this during COVID. Mm. So what was that experience like of thinking about pandemics and the way they affect our lives?
It was so interesting, actually. And one of the... I suppose anyone who's written a book during the pandemic and included something about either the Spanish flu or the current pandemic, one of the difficulties is pulling back because our experience of the pandemic was so acute. Mm-hmm. You know, we lived it in a way that prior to COVID, people writing about the Spanish flu didn't really have an experience of that, and so we were genuinely imagining it. We didn't have to imagine the Spanish flu in the way other writers have had to imagine it post that era, because we were living it. And interestingly, the public health measures that were put in place during the Spanish flu and COVID were exactly the same. The things that worked were exactly the same. They didn't have vaccination, obviously, but masks and social distancing and so on are the measures that were put in place. And I had a sense, though, what I couldn't have written before is some of the reactions that you have to people who are coughing or... Mm-hmm. Being in a workplace where someone has come in and they're not quite well, or they've had COVID and have they come back too early? Like all these social and emotional reactions to being in a community where there is a pandemic circulating, that is something that I could just record in my diary and then perhaps use in the writing of the experience of the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. But what I had to be really careful of was not focusing too much on it, because it was an experience that I was living. Mm-hmm. That this wasn't about the Spanish flu. This book isn't about that. And so just like the war, the Spanish flu just has to be something that my characters are engaging with, coming in contact with, dealing with in their everyday. And I had to remember that this becomes their everyday. Mm-hmm. It doesn't become the focus of their life.
Yeah. I'm going to ask one more question and then we're going to open up to you. So if the microphone will be in this middle aisle here. I think we might have a few people who want to ask questions today, so I'm going to ask you to be really concise with your questions so we can get through a few people. So I'll ask my last one and then over to you. I think we've spoken about this and around this a lot today, but what is it that you love about writing and the process of being an author?
One thing I didn't say earlier when you said what was my relationship with language, unfortunately, I'm really no good at anything else. So my parents might have wanted to steer me towards dance or, you know, visual arts or music, but all attempts were futile. And so the only way I could express myself was through words and language, and that's always been the case. I've always written poems and in diaries and so on. As a child, it was never for anyone but me, which if you're dyslexic is excellent because no one's judging you, you're not sharing it. But it's like doing scales. The more you write, the better you become. Writing for me is... when I wrote my memoir, One Italian Summer, I have to admit, I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to publish a book. One Italian Summer, in many ways, was an apprenticeship to creative writing. I'd always written for all of my jobs, but that was all non-fiction or academic-type writing, very, very different exercise to creative writing. So the memoir was a bit of an apprenticeship, and I have to admit, I hated it most of the time. I procrastinated a lot. I was depressed almost every day that I had given over to writing. I either didn't write or I didn't write enough. And so my mental health suffered, actually, because I wasn't able to do this thing that I thought I really wanted to do. And I just approached it slightly differently when I started writing The Dictionary of Lost Words, because I really wanted to love it. You know, it's something I'd always done, always aspired to. I really wanted to enjoy the process of writing in the way I'd enjoyed it as a child. And so I changed the parameters, essentially, and I decided I only ever had to write one word a day. And if I wrote one word, that was my word count kind of goal, I'd succeeded. And it's amazing. I am the biggest overachiever because sometimes I write 10 words or 20, sometimes a whole paragraph, sometimes 300 words. I probably rarely write more than 600 words a day, but every single time I put any word down, I have worked and I've written and I enjoy it 98% of the time. That's the gift of it to me, and I don't want to spoil it by making it, turning it into having expectations that are just too high for me to reach. Mm-hmm. I always want to enjoy it.
Yeah, mm. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pip. How would you write about a historical woman, a real person, from whom you only have silence or very little?
That's actually a great question. So I have done that a couple of times. In both of these books, there are real historical women. Edith Thompson is probably the best example in the Dictionary of Lost Words. She was someone who volunteered for the Oxford English Dictionary. She volunteered on every single volume of the dictionary, and when it was finally published in full, she was not invited to the celebratory dinner, even though men who'd worked on it for 6 months were. And she'd worked on it for 50 years of her life. And her name was Edith Thompson. You can find about half a page of information about her in the history books, and that's only because she wrote a biography of her grandfather, who was a parliamentarian. And there's another woman, Izzo Ray, in The Bookbinder of Jericho, who is a visual artist, a painter, who lived in Etaples in France and actually was a VAD in the same place that Tilda is a VAD in that book. And she has a cameo in The Bookbinder of Jericho, and for the same reason. She was a woman who was an established, critically acclaimed artist at the time, and she wasn't asked to be a war artist, even though she was right in the middle of it. And so she instead volunteered as a nurse and drew and painted in the very few hours that she had available to her. And her paintings of France and this army base are beautiful. And they are in the archives of the War Memorial in Canberra, but not on the wall. So it's hard to write about them in full because you are making some stuff up. But actually there are, like so many of us, there are whispers of them in the archives and in the history books. And you make the rest up, I suppose, from having a broad understanding of the kind of life they might have led, you know, from other works that you read. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello, I've been waiting to ask this question since I saw you last time about Dictionary of Lost Words. Not very intellectual question, but...
Oh, thank God.
But do you have a favourite word?
I do.
Or maybe a word that you actually don't like, because I can't spell, so I don't like any words that I can't spell.
I do. I have a couple of favourite words, and I have lots of favourite words, but the two that stand out is pastinacious, and anyone who's seen me talk might have heard these two words before. These are both words that I found in the dictionaries at the State Library. At the time of being included in the Oxford English Dictionary, they were already obsolete. So the whole idea of the OED was to chronicle the English language past and present, so every single word. And so these words were already obsolete, not in use at all, but I really think we should bring them back. Pastinacious, the definition of that is someone who has the character of a parsnip, which I think is gorgeous. But my absolute favourite, and I just don't understand why it isn't still in use, is satisdiction. And I usually like to end a talk with that word because it means having said enough.
Yeah. Thank you.
Pip, I've been a collector of private presses, UK private presses, for almost 50 years, which are works of art, if I may say, deriving from the arts and crafts movement of William Morris, the Kelmscott Press and the Ashendene Press that followed. I wonder, in terms of today, whether in your research you ever spoke to or worked or saw some of the current private press publishers who work solo in their binding in the most extraordinary way. Very rarely would there be more than two people who would be working in a private press in the UK in a very unique way. And I'm just wondering whether you're able to talk to any of these people.
I have spoken to a couple of people who are sort of private binders. In Australia in particular, there are still a lot of bookbinders around, and most of them work privately or on bespoke bookbinding, and often on repair, book repair. Because the way we bind books now has completely changed. You know, my book in particular is an example of the binding process. The first time a hand touches a book is usually the bookseller opening the box of books. It doesn't touch, no one touches it between, you know, throughout the entire process. So it's a very different process now, but the bookbinders I have spoken to who don't work at libraries and so on have been people who've been in the industry often since their teenage years, and they're now in their 80s and sometimes 90s, but they are still commissioned to repair old books. And some of these people have come along to talks I've done and brought some of the books that they've worked on, and it's an extraordinary craft. And the one good thing is, though, it's also becoming a popular pastime for people to learn, like so many other things. Many people are learning to bookbind now, which I think is wonderful, because it would be such a shame to lose the talent, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Pip.
Hi.
I've so much enjoyed seeing the story that you tell from two different perspectives with both of your books. And I wonder if you finished telling us all of the stories about that world, or do you have more in train for us?
Well, just secretly, don't tell anyone. I am working on another book, and I'm working on two other books, and one of them is contemporary and has nothing to do with Oxford or any of the characters that you might have read. But the other story, which I have to admit has kind of taken me by the hand and is pulling me along, is another story. I wouldn't call it a companion the way these two are companions. These two really do talk to each other in many ways, context, style, location, all of that sort of thing. But there is a character in the next book that everybody would recognise. But it will be a different style and a slightly different book. But yes, it will be familiar. Mm.
Thank you.
That's enigmatic, isn't it?
We've still got time for a few more questions if anyone else would like to step up to the microphone. But on that, I wonder sort of if you could mention, what was it about the characters that exist in both of these books? What was it about them that you wanted to spend more time with as a writer?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting thing when you write a book. When I finished Dictionary of Lost Words, I genuinely wasn't over it. I wasn't over Oxford. I enjoyed many of the people who were in that book, but who I couldn't give space to because it wasn't their story. I didn't, in Bookbinder of Jericho, I didn't necessarily take one of the characters from Dictionary and expand their story. I had a completely new character because I did want to explore that world from a working class perspective. Mm-hmm. But of course, there is a lot of a few characters walk on the pages of Bookbinder who walked on the pages of Dictionary, Gareth in particular, and Tilda Taylor. And Tilda was interesting because in Dictionary of Lost Words, she's an actress, she's a suffragette, she's in some ways two-dimensional. She's a stereotype of a suffragette, and I wanted to explore what war might do to a woman like that. Mm-hmm. And so she is in the Bookbinder as the letter writer. She's a woman who volunteers as a VAD and goes to war. And I was very interested in how war would change her and her perspective on things. When you spend years, I've now spent, you know, more than, how long have I, I've spent 6 years with these characters. And especially the characters who are secondary in one of the novels, they still have a lot of backstory and a lot of living to do in my head. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I still want to explore that but the book I'm writing isn't the right place to do that. And it is like an alternative universe. I'm quite I'm an introverted person, and I do like to spend a lot of time alone. And, you know, I become quite fond of these people and exploring their lives.
Great. Mm. Thank you.
Pip, you've partially answered my question. It was regarding Tilda. And I wonder if you could comment a bit on the role that she played in the interaction with Peggy and her family and her community, because although it's quite a small role, it's definitely there.
Yeah, thank you for the question. In both books, there's a letter writer. It's Edith Thompson in the first book and Tilda Taylor in the second. And I needed a way for, because these books are both written in first person, when you write in first person, everything that the reader knows comes from the experience of the narrator of the book. But sometimes there's things that you want the reader to know that the narrator doesn't necessarily, or you want the reader to know something that the narrator can only get secondhand. And so Tilda writes letters from ETAP, from the army base in France, and that tells Peggy, goodness, that tells Peggy, but it also tells the reader about the war. And so that was my way of bringing the war into the novel. But also Tilda was very close to Peggy and Maud's mother. And so she's a link to the past for those two young women. She's a link to the war for those two young women. She's a link to the women's suffrage movement for those two young women. So she represents quite a lot. And yeah, but as you say, she has very little time on the page, really, but hopefully enough time that the reader understands the importance of those other things to the story. Yeah.
Thank you.
What's happened to the 7 books that you bound? They must be very precious, and did they, are they in a precious spot or given to precious people?
Yes, some of them have been given to precious people, and I'm hoping all of them actually stay together. there's still a few on my bookshelf. I'll give one each to my sons, but only, you know, when I know they'll look after them. So.
We've got time for one more question. Thank you.
Pip, thank you very much for your books that have brought my book club much joy.
Thank you.
My question, I heard an interview with Conversations. I'm wondering if it might be your Peter, who said that the winners of the Booker Prize get a hand-bound leather gold filigreed book. Are you aware?
I'm not aware of that.
It's either the book or another, but it was a fascinating interview, and I'm wondering if this is your Peter.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Okay. I actually don't know. His name's Peter Zajac. As long as they don't get me to bind them, that would be. That sounds like a lovely idea.
Great. Thank you so much. Everyone, please join me in thanking Pip.
Thank you. Thank you very much.